Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, rebranding Obamacare. What makes a commodity? And a conversation from the Comcast corner office. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 21st of November. Glad you could join us. And there you go, 16,009.99 on the Dow today. Anything else we need to say about that? No? All right. Let's move on. How about the Senate and the filibuster then, the changes? Anything there for us, marketplace, business, and economy-wise? Nah, I don't think so, not really. So, what about Obamacare, or as the White House would now apparently prefer, the Affordable Care Act? They haven't been using Obamacare much at the White House lately. And the president said the other day his health care law is going to need some serious rebranding when it launches. So, bearing in mind that no matter how bad Obamacare has been, people gotta buy insurance because it's the law, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what a good marketing campaign might look like.
First thing first, this is out.
Obamacare.
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 This is in.
The Affordable Care Act.
The Affordable Care Act.
The Affordable Care Act.
In his hour-long speech last week, Obama didn't utter the word Obamacare once. Good choice, says Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup, the polling giant. Newport says research out this week shows people responded very differently to the two labels.
Sure enough, if you say Obamacare, don't mention Affordable Care Act, you get the most negative reaction.
Gallup found only 38% of Americans approve when they hear Obamacare, but approval jumped to 45% when saying the Affordable Care Act. Of course, the larger point is, no matter what you call it, more than half of Americans still don't like the new health care law.
The North Star here for the Obama administration on this issue is trust.
PR crisis consultant Chris Lehane, who worked in the Clinton White House and knows his share of controversy, says rebranding means reestablishing credibility.
Every single comment that's made needs to be through that prism. Does this enhance our credibility or does this imperil our credibility?
Lehane says even if they're modest, the White House must string together a series of accomplishments to prove the administration can deliver. But the administration will be dodging bullets every step of the way. Republicans are trying to undermine the law. They've got a 17-page battle plan, and the law is under assault from insurers.
Things don't always work like they're supposed to. Good thing the government exchange website isn't the only place to buy health insurance. Just visit wellmark.com/simple.
That Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield ad is running in Iowa and South Dakota. But no matter how bad Obamacare / Affordable Care Act has been, it's got one big advantage. People have to have insurance. It's the law. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The number two retail chain in this country, Target, had some things to say about its earnings forecast this morning. Sales expectations for the year were lowered. Profits this past quarter were down by almost half. The company actually blamed Canada for some of that. Its expansion out into the wintry north is not going so well, apparently. And back on this side of the border, shoppers don't seem to have a whole lot of disposable income. And in an economy that is still recovering, what does the future hold for a discount store that relies on the disposable income of those with the least of it? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Walk into the Target in downtown Los Angeles and you'll notice bright, shiny floors, racks of clothes with designer names attached, and store manager Simone Tatro can tell you who all of this is for, the ideal Target customer.
She works. She's successful. She has some children at home, but she really loves the finer things in life. But she, of course, has come to expect our, you know, expect more, pay less brand promise.
Target's marketing strategy has always been to offer a more upscale experience than Walmart. And Wharton marketing professor Stephen Hoke says they do that from the moment you walk in the door.
But it's the farther you get back in the store, the more Target starts looking like a Walmart.
But ultimately, Target and Walmart are going after the same lower and middle income customers. But since the recession, they're spending less of their income on non-essentials. And they were especially hard hit by the 2 percentage point increase in the Social Security payroll tax January 1st. Target's response has been to focus on its more affluent customers, says retail analyst Amy Koo.
The idea is that they've been focused on this Target guest that is specifically higher income and is more able to spend.
But even the spending of those customers has plateaued, says Koo. Last week, the CEO of Walmart's international division, Doug McMillan, said consumer spending in both developed and emerging markets was down, and he expected that trend to persist through the remainder of the year. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
There was polite applause at the big board today as the Dow closed above the big 1-6. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You got your oil, you got your precious metals and your pork bellies, wheat and corn as well. Commodities, writ large. The commodities market has been on quite a ride since the financial crisis. Traders looking for something other than stocks into which to put their money. Commodities have generally been a lesser known part of the broad investing universe, but now mutual funds and regular old investors are trying their hand at it. What is a commodity anyway, though, and why do they need their own markets? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
If anyone knows a commodity when he sees one, it's Lane Carlson. He's the chief regulatory officer at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange.
What makes something a commodity? Well, anything where something can be contracted for future delivery. In essence, you could have basketballs, you could have pencils as a type of commodity.
Okay, people don't actually trade basketball and pencil futures yet. What they do trade are raw materials, like lumber, cotton, and oil. To qualify as a commodity, an item has to be pretty uniform, says Dan Montrenac, a commodities analyst for Doane Advisory Services. He says a true commodity has the same value no matter where it's from or who produced it.
Corn is a classic example of a commodity. A cereal manufacturer who makes cornflakes will buy anybody's corn as long as it meets certain quality standards. It's grade number 2 corn.
Also, a steady supply of that product has to be critical to a lot of companies.
These are the apples at the beginning of the packing line, and we're packing Fuji today.
Jeff Christ owns a 600-acre apple orchard in New York's Hudson Valley. We're standing beside the flume in his packing plant. Thousands of Fuji apples are bobbing along in a moving water bath. Here the apples get washed, dried, waxed, and then polished with giant round brushes before getting boxed up and shipped all over the country. Around 20% of Chris's apples are turned into juice. Apple juice is the newest commodity on the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. Lane Carlson says a few years back, beverage companies got together and asked for it.
The Juice Products Association said, hey, we have a commodity that has a lot of price volatility. We're looking for a means to help offset that price risk.
Beverage companies had started using a lot of apple juice. Chinese consumers have developed a taste for it, so demand has soared. And apple juice is increasingly being used to sweeten other juices and food products. Companies had been buying their apple juice old school, making individual deals with individual farmers. But as demand for apple juice increased, more companies realized they needed to turn apple juice into a commodity. And just in time.
We had severe freeze in 2012, which froze off in some orchards almost all the viable buds.
Jeff Christ is standing near a row of his Empire apple trees. It's a frosty autumn day, and freshly harvested trees stretch out in every direction. Last year, Christ lost almost all of the fruit on these trees. Honeycrisp, Red Delicious, Rome. The freeze destroyed half his crop.
The 2012 crop was probably the poorest crop of apples grown east of the Mississippi in the last 50 to 100 years. Juice prices, at least in my lifetime, and reached an all-time high due to the shortage.
Because apple juice was a commodity, companies were able to protect themselves. When a commodity is traded on an exchange, companies can buy futures contracts. That means they can buy the apple juice they need months or even years in advance. They risk paying more than they'd have to if prices fall. But if there's a freeze and prices jump, they're locked in. Farmers like Jeff Christ can use the futures market too.
Wow, that's good.
They can sell their apple juice at a certain price to beverage companies before the apples are even picked.
Some got huge flavor. It's juicy and crunchy.
Not that Christ is worried about money right now. After the disastrous crop of 2012, this year's crop is one of the best he's ever seen.
I'm going to take another bite.
In Walden, New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We're getting to that point of the year when movie awards season draws nigh, and there have been a bunch of good ones this year, a lot of them with something in common: big, important movies made by black filmmakers starring black actors. Wesley Morris is a film critic at Grantland. We have him on from time to time, including today right here in L.A. Wesley, it's really nice to talk to you.
It's nice to see you.
Here in the Frank Stanton Studios.
I can't believe it.
I know, right? What do you make of this premise, that this is quite the year for black films?
It's true. Well, I mean, in terms of the diversity of subject matter,
yeah.
I mean, there was a point at which you could say it was a good year for black films.
Right,
everything
exactly.
was booty call.
But, okay, let's not do that.
Right. No, but I mean, that was the case in the late 90s, where you had a wealth of movies that were all aimed at the same audience.
Right.
And that created this black movie ghetto, and that wasn't terribly interesting, and it was not lucrative.
And also it's offensive. I mean, hello?
Yes, yeah.
Right?
But I mean, the idea that it was alienating
on
two different fronts, both commercially and probably and definitely sociopolitically, that was a problem.
Now, how come it's changed? How come this year we've got – I mean, there are awesome movies out there, you know, 12 Years a Slave, The Butler, all of that.
Yeah. I think the difference is you have more black producers and directors who have enough clout now to be able to get these movies made more or less on their own terms. A lot of the movies that came out in the late 90s were also by black directors.
Yeah, exactly.
But the difference now is that there are more people at the studio level – able to support this sort of more ambitious filmmaking.
Are we getting smarter as audiences? Are we just getting more accepting and eager for these kinds of movies?
I wonder. I think
because you know what,
is...
Tron and Thor and all that—they're going to do a zillion dollars
right.
at the box office.
They don't, and they are colorblind. They don't care who sees them. And I think in the case of these movies, the goal is to have it be equally as colorblind. But I mean, obviously a large portion of those audiences are people of color. And I think in the case of The Best Man Holiday, which made $30 million over the weekend, is a lot of money for a movie that didn't seem to me to be that popular. I mean, the first movie that movie made more than the first movie made. Almost. Like, I think the first one made 46.
Yeah, I don't even know. And at a certain point, the dollars don't matter, right?
The dollars don't matter. Well, they do, actually.
The dollars
are really important because if Best Man Holiday, for instance, made maybe $10 million.
Yeah.
And it would have wound up – it would have covered its production costs
right.
and maybe turned a profit. $30 million is a bona fide hit the opening weekend, and it also says to the studios that there's an audience out there for this sort of movie at this level.
Yeah,
and
but you know what? So what's going to happen next year?
Hopefully.
Right? There have been these great movies.
The Oscars
will come in February,
and
everybody from 12 Years a Slave will be nominated, and people from The Butler will be nominated, Oprah and
Forrest Whitaker.
Forrest Whitaker, right? And then what?
Hopefully,
that's the test, right?
Well, right.
Putting together a bunch of these years.
And every year, it seems like every 5 years we have this, oh, it's a great year for X people of color. And then, there's a drought. But the thing I think that makes the difference this year is that the money can't be discounted because it suggests that there's an audience that demands that these things be seen.
Wesley Morris covers films for Grantland. Really good to have you in the studio.
Nice to be here.
Coming up,
we have to be the best service provider, or in the end, this company won't be what I hope it will be.
We report, you decide. Comcast on Conversations from the Corner Office. But first, let's do the numbers. Ah, Sweet 16 and the really happy music. The Dow Industrials jumped 109 points today, 2/3%. Closed above that number for the first time, 16,009, as I said at the top. All of the indices, as it happens, are nearing round number landmarks. The NASDAQ keeps eking closer to 3,700. The tech-heavy index tacked on 47 points today, 1.2%. Finished at 3,969. The S&P 500 gained 14 points, 0.8%. Ended things at 1,795. Retail, again, in the spotlight. As you heard earlier, a lack of low-income consumers dragged down Target. Shares finished off nearly 3.5% today. But high-income folks do seem willing to spend. Williams-Sonoma reported that customers were buying last quarter. Williams-Sonoma jumped 7.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.78%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on housing finance reform. And let's end on a food note. Or maybe it's a love note. November is National Peanut Butter Lovers Month. According to the National Peanut Board, Americans spend almost $800 million on peanut butter each year. People, that's really spreading it on thick. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't know that this is necessarily the news you want as we head into 6 or so weeks worth of crowded airports, packed airplanes, and delayed flights. But the skies are going to start getting even less friendly. Both United and Delta Airlines said this month they're going to change their frequent flyer plans to make you use a lot more miles to get free seats. The changes start next year, and as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, they are the future of flying.
Airlines love customers like Everton Morris.
With my United balance, I have a lifetime miles balance of a little over 905,000 miles.
He shops with the right credit cards and has multiple apps on his phone to check his mileage balance.
Because next, of course, my bank balance, that's the most important thing.
So when he found out that buying a United ticket with miles would cost 62% more in some cases, he was...
Certainly was not at all happy about that because I tend to redeem for international trips.
The most significant hikes are for business and first-class international flights, and Delta Airlines has hiked the price in miles for its flights twice in the past 4 months.
We are definitely experiencing mile inflation, and that's got a lot of frequent flyers pretty outraged.
George Hobica is founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. Basically, people's miles are going to be worth a lot less, and consumers will have to spend more to qualify for certain loyalty programs. One reason for the mile depreciation, says Hobica, is supply.
They're handing out miles like candy at Halloween.
But there's more to it than that, says Seth Kaplan, editor at Airline Weekly.
Flights are often fuller now, and so they give a seat to somebody. That's a seat that somebody else might have paid for, not a seat that would have otherwise been empty.
Tim Winship is an editor with SmartTravel.com. He says what's really behind mileage inflation is industry consolidation, like the upcoming merger between U.S. Airways and American.
You have fewer airlines competing against each other, which means they can become less customer-friendly.
And he says consumers can't really do much about it. Everton Morris would switch, but he's so close to getting lifetime gold premier status.
When you get heavily invested and the mileage accrual and the mileage promos and whatnot, you know, it becomes tougher and tougher to switch.
So his plan is to burn as many miles as possible before the new rates go into effect, starting with flying his family to Asia. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The family-run business is a pillar of the American economy. So, too, is the giant conglomerate. It's rare, though, that those two traits are combined in the same company.
The boss will see you now.
So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, a local cable company founded by his father 50 years ago, but which now owns NBC Universal, professional sports franchises, internet providers, a lot, in other words. We talked a couple of weeks ago at Comcast headquarters in Philadelphia.
Brian Roberts.
Brian, Ty Rizdahl, nice to see you. How
are
you?
Nice to see you.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
Fabulous.
As
so
you
we're
can
do it right here, right
you,
now.
We're
just
do it
like
right
this.
Now.
You're oh
ready?
My
if
gosh.
You're not ready, man, we can come back. No. As we sit here surrounded by all of this stuff, by which I mean home security stuff and television stuff and entertainment stuff and everything, the question that comes to mind is, what business are you guys in?
Well, I think we have a very unique company at Comcast, NBC Universal. It's an exciting time. Technology is changing everything really fast. But if you look at our company, by probably next year, we will have more broadband connections to people's homes than we will have cable TV connections to people's homes. And we were thought of as a cable company to start. So my answer is, I don't want to be pigeonholed into just one thing. It is the beauty of this business is we reinvent ourselves every couple of years.
I'm going to make you choose. In 5 years, what's going to be more important in this company, the pipes or the content? Because if I have Hulu and Amazon Prime and Netflix, why do I need your why do I need, you know, Comcast?
Well,
why
let me
I need
start with the first thing we hope you'll need is the fastest internet on the planet. And we have more internet customers than anybody in America. So
say that again. That's an amazing
statistic.
We have more
statistic. Connections to the internet than any other residentially than any other company in America. We hope we will, 5 years from now, have compelling programming, compelling choices, compelling sports, compelling live television on all these devices. You say, in addition to those products you mentioned, of course I want to buy their triple play. And it's a great deal because they also offer me a telephone and home security and energy management and wherever we go next during that 5 years. So the key for us is to move quickly, to have a company that feels like a 50-year-old startup, and to be young. And you're sitting in our labs here where a lot of these products are coming from, but they're going to come from outsiders as well. And that's the culture of what we're trying to build at the company.
As you're taking such time and effort and investment, it must be said, to make this a more appealing consumer-facing company, right? I mean, you want consumers to want you. How come you have such a lousy consumer-facing reputation? I mean, you guys rank in the bottom of all the consumer surveys.
Well, that's a very fair criticism that we're working really hard to fix. What unfortunately happens is we have about, I could be wrong on this number, but it's directionally right, about 350 million interactions with consumers a year between phone calls and truck rolls. It may be over 400 million. And that doesn't count any online interactions, which are over, I think, a billion. You get 0.1% bad experience. That's a lot of people, unacceptable. We have to be the best service provider, or in the end, this company won't be what I hope it will be.
This is kind of a sideways question, but go with me here for a minute. This company is the biggest media communications entertainment company in the world by a long shot. You're the third biggest phone company in this country. You're the biggest broadband provider, as you've said. Yet here you sit, a very mild-mannered guy by all appearances, running what is in essence a family business. I mean, you took over from your dad who started this company. Have you benefited by being able to ride a little bit under the radar, do you think?
No, I don't think we ride too much under the radar. As you said, there's plenty of visibility and transparency to when we do well and when we don't do well. But I do think we've benefited by being a family-started business. And this is we're celebrating our 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. My dad's 93. He comes to work and people...
What does he say? He must say, Brian, this is crazy stuff.
He says, this is crazy stuff and I can't believe it, but let's keep going. And It's enthralling. And if you go to Silicon Valley, we now have 1,000 software engineers at Comcast, maybe as many as Facebook or more. But you wouldn't think of the company that way. So changing a company that's 50 years old and keeping the culture of a founder is what I think my job's all about.
Brian, thanks very much. Appreciate
it. Good to be with you.
Take care.
You can hear a longer version of my chat with Brian Roberts on our new Marketplace Reader. It's an app that's got video, more audio, and extended interviews with the CEOs of Starbucks, Kickstarters, even Spanx in this edition. You can download it on iTunes or at marketplace.org. Also, we need a new name for the thing. Marketplace Reader just doesn't do it for me. So check it out and then tweet us with a better one. You can get us at MarketplaceAPM or you can get me at Kai Rizdahl.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which, and I know I've used this phrase before, but this time I really mean it. This might actually be this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. This afternoon, the Wall Street Journal, citing, quote, people familiar with the matter, said the Federal Communications Commission is going to take up whether or not to allow cell phones to be used on planes, as in while actually flying, while you're trapped for hours and hours. I'm right. Apocalypse. I know it. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this one Thursday. It is today. The Dow up 109 points, 0.2%, 16,000 and change. The NASDAQ tacked on 47 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 14 points. That is 0.75%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.